Hello and welcome to Greatest Britons. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today's Greatest Briton is T.E. Lawrence, or better known as Lawrence of Arabia. And my co-host for the presentation is, of course, Max Musson from Western Spring. Yeah, I think everyone was back then. Everybody was more right-wing than they are today. And we also had a higher level of intelligence and more general knowledge. Standards continually seem to keep slipping. Or shall we move back to a time when we had much higher standards than Max? Shall we talk about our greatest Britons for the week?
Yes, that would be interesting. Very interesting.
And our greatest Briton for this week is Lawrence of Arabia, Colonel Thomas Edward Lawrence, CBDSO, born 16th of August 1888, died 19th of May 1935, was a British archaeologist, an army officer, a diplomat, and a writer who became renowned for his role in the Arab Revolt of 1916 to 1918 and the Sinai and Palestine Campaign of 1915 to 1918, which was against the Ottoman Empire during the First World War. The breadth and variety of his activities and associations and his ability to describe them vividly in writing earned him international fame as Lawrence of Arabia, a title used for the 1962 film based on his wartime activities. And I'll just stop there before we go into more of a description of his life there. I mean, I find him interesting because he was a British archaeologist, and we'll see that he was tied in with some of the other archaeologists that we've been mentioning recently, and also this Arab revolt, which eventually led to Syria, and I guess eventually after that, the Syrian Arab League, and this nationalism, because we often talk about British nationalism, white nationalism, but what we actually had here is Arab nationalism. And I must admit, I've heard of Lawrence of Arabia before, but I don't really know that much about him. I know that there is a conspiracy theory around his death that we'll get into when we get to that point. But I know you've looked into his life before, Max. You know a bit about him. Do you want to add any comments here before we get into his early life?
Just that he is somebody who, again, could be regarded in certain respects not to the same degree as some of the other greatest Britons we've discussed recently. But again, he isn't quite a polymath, but he is somebody of high intelligence who taught himself to speak Pashtun, I think it was, and who went out to the Middle East as an archaeologist. And then as the First World War broke out, he joined the army, but then was sent out to Sinai and Palestine to continue his work as an archaeologist, but to act as an intelligence officer for the army, using that as his cover, effectively. But that during the time that he was out in the Middle East, he formed quite a strong bond with a number of the Arab leaders, and that this caused him to feel a tremendous amount of anguish when he realised that the aspirations of the Arab nationalists, who were trying to free themselves from the Ottoman Empire, those aspirations were dashed by the British government at the time, and when the Balfour Declaration effectively signalled that the British Empire was going to hand control of what is now Israel over to the Jews, and so he was severely vexed by that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, you can't blame him, really. I mean, he'd been given sort of he'd been assured that what he was saying was going to happen, and that the British would stand by their word to the Arabs, and then they didn't. I mean, it's very bad behaviour by the British. We'll get into all of that. Continuing with this summary of his life here. He was born out of wedlock in August 1888 to Sarah Jenner, a governess, and Sir Thomas Chapman, 7th Baronet, an Anglo-Irish nobleman. There's a bit of a rarity there to be born out of wedlock back then, and also to nobility. Chapman left his wife and family in Ireland to cohabit with Jenner. Chapman and Jenner called themselves Mr. and Mrs. Lawrence, using the surname of Sarah's likely father. So Sarah had also been born out of wedlock. So interesting here that we see that both generations were. Her mother had been employed as a servant for a Lawrence family when she became pregnant with Sarah. In 1896, the Lawrences moved to Oxford, where Thomas attended the high school and then studied history at Jesus College, Oxford, from 1907 to 1910. From 1910 to 1914, he worked as an archaeologist for the British Museum, chiefly at Carchemish in Ottoman Syria. Soon after the outbreak of war in 1914, he volunteered for the British Army and was stationed at the Arab Bureau, which was established in 1916, the intelligence unit in Egypt. In 1916, he travelled to Mesopotamia and on to Arabia on intelligence missions and became involved with the Arab revolt as a liaison to the Arab forces, along with other British officers, supporting the Arab Kingdom of Hejaz's independence war against its former overlord, the Ottoman Empire. So the enemy of my enemy is my friend, is the theory that was being worked on here. He worked closely with Emir Faisal, a leader of the revolt, and he participated, sometimes as leader, in military actions against the Ottoman armed forces, culminating in the capture of Damascus in October 1918. After the First World War, Lawrence joined the British Foreign Office, working with the British government and with Faisal. In 1922, he retreated from public life and spent the years until 1935 serving as an enlisted man, mostly in the Royal Air Force, with a brief period in the Army. During this time, he published his best-known work, Seven Pillars of Wisdom, an autobiographical account of his participation in the Arab Revolt. He also translated books into English and wrote The Mint, which detailed his time in the RAF working as an ordinary aircraftman. He corresponded extensively and was friendly with well-known artists, writers, and politicians. And for the RAF, he participated in the development of rescue motorboats. Lawrence's public image resulted in part from the sensationalised reporting of the Arab Revolt by American journalist Lowell Thomas, as well as from Seven Pillars of Wisdom. On 19th of May 1935, Lawrence died at the age of 46, 6 days after being injured in a motorcycle accident in Dorset. So he's mainly famous for this Arab Revolt. And also there was this picture that was taken of him dressed up in his Arab clothes. And there was a big display, I think it was, or a theatre display. And there was an explorer that would talk about this. And Lawrence's adventures with the Arabs also played a part in this. I haven't actually read his book. Have you read his book, Max? Do you know anything about that?
I have read parts of it. I didn't read it from cover to cover, but I have read parts of it. But that was quite a long time ago. But the general tenor of the book was that Lawrence had become disenchanted with the way in which the British Empire was dealing with the Arabs, and particularly the Arab groups that he had formed quite a strong friendship with, and who had sacrificed a lot in battles that were aimed at pushing back the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire was actually quite a large empire, for those that don't know, that existed from about the 13th century all the way through to the early part of the 20th century. It was a multiracial empire. And as a result of that, and as a result of trying to enforce conformity and Islam over, in a one form of Islam over all the various peoples that consisted the Ottoman Empire, it caused a lot of strife between the individual groups and caused Arab nationalism to arise. And various Arab groups wanted to have independence and self-rule for themselves. And it was that Lawrence played upon in getting their agreement to help fight against the Ottoman Empire.
I guess at the Versailles Treaty, then they must have not given the Arabs what it was that they deserved, in the same way that Germany was carved up. Nobody was happy with this Versailles Treaty at the end of it. We'll get into all of that as we get there. We'll have a look at his early life. Thomas Edward Lawrence was born on 16th August 1888 in Tremadog, Carnarvonshire, Wales, that's in North Wales, in a house named Gorff Wisfar, now known as Snowdon Lodge, so must be up there near Mount Snowdon. The couple had five sons, Thomas, called Ned by his immediate family, being the second eldest. From Wales, the family moved to Kirkcudbright, Galloway in southwestern Scotland, then to Dinard in Brittany, and then on to Jersey. So they certainly moved about. The family lived at Langley Lodge, now demolished, from 1894 to 1896, set in private woods between the eastern borders of the New Forest and Southampton Water in Hampshire. The residence was isolated, and the young Lawrence had many opportunities for outdoor activities and waterfront visits. In the summer of 1896, the family moved to 2 Polstead Road in Oxford, where they lived until 1921. Lawrence attended the City of Oxford High School for Boys from 96 until 07, where one of the 4 houses was later named Lawrence in his honour. The school closed in 1966. Lawrence and one of his brothers became commissioned officers in the Church Lads Brigade at St Aldate's Church. And Lawrence claimed that he ran away from home around 1905 and served for a few weeks as a boy soldier with the Royal Garrison Artillery at St Moore's Castle in Cornwall, from which he was bought out. However, no evidence of this appears in the army records. Well, it wouldn't really appear in the army records, would it, if it was illegal for him to be there if he was a boy soldier. But I think this shows us that he must have come from quite a wealthy family, and they moved around a lot. To places that were traditionally British, Brittany, then Jersey, Scotland, Wales, England, all parts of, most parts of the United Kingdom or Great Britain. And I think he had, he didn't want for anything during his childhood, I don't think. And obviously went to a good school and ended up at university. I guess they must have moved to Oxford wanting him to go to university. Do you know any of these places that are talked about here, Max? Got any comments on that?
No, not with any with any significance. As you said, I knew that his family moved around quite a bit whilst he was younger, but other than that, I don't know any more. No,
must have given him a good experience seeing, you know, the various different countries of the United Kingdom, England, Scotland, Wales. And he didn't. It sounds like he didn't see Northern Ireland, but he saw the rest of them. Well, at age 15, Lawrence and his school friend Cyril Beeson cycled around Berkshire, Buckinghamshire and Oxfordshire, visiting almost every village's parish church, studying their monuments and antiquities, and making rubbings of their monumental brasses. Lawrence and Beeson monitored building sites in Oxford and presented the Ashmolean Museum with anything that they found. The Ashmolean's annual report for 1906 said that the 2 teenage boys, by incessant watchfulness, secured everything of antiquarian value which has been found. In the summers of 1906 and 1907, Lawrence toured France by bicycle, sometimes with Beeson, collecting photographs, drawings and measurements of medieval castles. In August 1907, Lawrence wrote home, "The Chagnons and Lamballe people complimented me on my wonderful French. I have been asked twice since I arrived what part of France I came from." So this is interesting. I mean, this shows that he's got an interest in history. He's got an interest in our heritage, and he wanted to make a record of it, taking rubbings of all these monumental brasses. And also you can see he's got this interest in archaeology there, looking at the building sites and collecting everything that he can found and giving it to the museum. And this is at just age 15. I'm not sure what age he was when he was touring France, but again, drawings and measurements of medieval castles. So
I wonder how many 15-year-old boys nowadays would spend their time doing that sort of thing, instead of glorying in all of these monumental pieces of masonry or statues or whatever pieces of art that they might find. Most boys of 15 nowadays are distracted by other things that are far less fruitful.
Yeah, computer games. Computer games, you know, they just sort of mimic the you know, real-life adventures, don't they? I mean, he's going out having proper adventures, travelling about, looking at castles, and, you know, that's a much better thing to do than sitting there playing computer games. And with Patriotic Alternative Wales, you know, go out and have a look at castles. And I'm sure they do the same in Patriotic Alternative Scotland. And this is the sort of thing that young lads should be doing. They should be travelling around the country and looking at our heritage. Of course, it might be a little bit too dangerous to do that sort of thing now as a young lad, but it wasn't back then, 100 years ago. From 1907 to 1910, Lawrence read history at Jesus College, Oxford, and in July and August of 1908, he cycled 2,200 miles solo through France to the Mediterranean and back, researching French castles again. In the summer of 1909, he set out alone on a three-month walking tour of Crusader castles in Ottoman Syria, during which he travelled 1,000 miles on foot. While at Jesus College, he was a keen member of the University Officers Training Corps. He graduated with first-class honours after submitting a thesis titled The Influence of the Crusades on European Military Architecture to the End of the 12th Century, partly based on his field research with Beeson in France and his solo research in France and the Middle East. Lawrence was fascinated by the Middle Ages. His brother Arnold wrote in 1937 that medieval researches were a dream way of escaping from bourgeois England. And it is interesting, the influence of the Crusades on military architecture and the castles in Britain. There's one in Wales that has this big spherical dome on it, and it's really, really heavy. And it was basically, it came from looking at the spherical dome in these castles when they went out on the Crusades, and then trying to mimic the same when they got back here to Britain. But they didn't quite have the ratio to correct. So that's why it's far too heavy and far too thick than it actually needed to be. But there was a lot of influence from out there that was taken on these castles that we had back here in Britain. So interesting that he was fascinated by
them. There are lots of churches that are named after individual Crusader knights as well.
Yeah,
those Crusader knights sent the fortune that they made through sort of conquest. They sent that fortune back so that those churches could be built.
They had a big link between the church and the military, something yeah. which people would probably be surprised to find out today. But that's exactly what the Crusades were, and it was the Christians fighting against the Muslims, and it was the church that was supporting that rather than inviting the Muslims in to hold their prayers within the church, as we've seen happen, I think, in Sweden a couple of years back. Well, this shows he's got this interest in history, he's got this interest in archaeology. In 1910, he was offered the opportunity to become a practicing archaeologist at Carchemish in the expedition that D.G. Hogarth was setting up on behalf of the British Museum. Hogarth arranged a senior demyship, which is a form of scholarship, for Lawrence at Magdalen College, Oxford, to fund his work at £100 a year. He sailed for Beirut in December 1910, went to Byblos, where he studied Arabic. He then went on to work at the excavations at Carchemish near Jarablus in northern Syria, where he worked under Hogarth, R. Campbell Thompson of the British Museum, and Leonard Woolley until 1914. And we mentioned Leonard Woolley in our podcast on Sir Flinders Petrie. And I think we might have mentioned him before as well. I talk about him anyway because of his work in Mesopotamia. And he later stated that everything which he had accomplished, he owed to Hogarth. Lawrence met Gertrude Bell whilst excavating at Carchemish, and he also worked briefly with Flinders Petrie in 1912 at Kafir Amar in Egypt. So he's working with all the top archaeologists of his day. At Carchemish, Lawrence was enrolled in a high-tension relationship with a German-led team working nearby on the Baghdad Railway at Jarablus. While there was never any open combat, there was regular conflict over access to land and treatment of the local workforce. Lawrence gained experience in Middle Eastern leadership practices and conflict resolution while he was there. So it sounds like he was another one that wasn't happy with the way that the workforce were being treated. That's similar to Flinders Petrie. And remember, Flinders Petrie was telling the workforce that they needed to find him small pieces and not rush through and to take their time. And Leonard Woolley, he was the guy that discovered the flood. And I think he was also responsible for discovering Ur of the Chaldees. So I guess you could say it's like a group of people that are all connected at the time, aren't they? Because we also got Sir Francis Galton and Carl Pearson that were connected through Flinders Petrie. And then you got Lawrence of Arabia. You got all these intellectual types that are also historians that are also incredibly fit. Because remember, you know, he's part of the military as well. So you've got people that are just very, very good at everything that they do. And also this Car Shemesh, the name itself, Car Shemesh, that car at the beginning of it, it's the same as Cardiff, and various other places that begin with that C-A-E-R in Wales, which shows you where our languages, go back to this area when white people were out there, and we still use the same terms in our language today. I can't off the top of my head think of other places that begin with Cardiff, like Car Shemesh, but there are actually lots of them still in Wales. And Carthage, of course, as well, in North Africa. Any thoughts on that? Caerphilly, yeah. There's loads of them. And this shows that link between the old British language, the Welsh language, and the language that they had out in the Near East. Do you want to add to that, Max?
No.
Okay. We'll have a look at military intelligence next. In January 1914, Woolley and Lawrence were co-opted by the British military as an archaeological smokescreen for a British military survey of the Negev Desert. They were funded by the Palestine Exploration Fund to search for an area referred to in the Bible as the Wilderness of Zin, and they made an archaeological survey of the Negev Desert along the way. The Negev was strategically important, as an Ottoman army attacking Egypt would have to cross it. Woolley and Lawrence subsequently published a report of the expedition's archaeological findings, but a much more important result was updated mapping of the area, with special attention to features of military relevance, such as water sources. Lawrence also visited Aqaba and Shobek, which is not far from Petra, and Petra is the modern name for Edom, the biblical area of Edom, where the Edomites lived, where the Edomians. Following the outbreak of hostilities in August 1914, Lawrence did not immediately enlist in the British Army. He held back until October on the advice of S.F. Newcomb, when he was commissioned on the general list. Before the end of the year, he was summoned by renowned archaeologist and historian, Lieutenant Commander David Hogarth, his mentor at Car Shemesh, to the new Arab Bureau Intelligence Unit in Cairo, and he arrived in Cairo on 15th December 1914. The Bureau's chief was General Gilbert Clayton, who reported to Egyptian High Commissioner Henry McMahon. So these archaeologists were seen as quite important. I mean, you wouldn't really have thought about that, but military intelligence. But if they're digging around these ruins, then at the same time, they can create maps. I guess it's rather like these explorers in the past that were going out searching for new areas. And at the same time, they would do the mapping, like Captain Cook in New Zealand. And I wasn't aware that L.A. Woolley was involved in this either. Go on.
Also, it suggests that a very large proportion of the military saw part of their role, not just of extending and defending the empire, but of extending and the knowledge that we had of those areas from an archaeological perspective, and protecting the sites and the artifacts that we found.
Well, definitely protecting them. That's always going to be important in the war, isn't it, to protect these things. Well, the situation was complex during 1915. There was a growing Arab nationalist movement within the Arabic-speaking Ottoman territories, including many Arabs that were actually serving in the Ottoman armed forces. They were in contact with Sharif Hussein, the Emir of Mecca, who was negotiating with the British and offering to lead an Arab uprising against the Ottomans. In exchange, he wanted a British guarantee of an independent Arab state, including the Hejaz, Syria, and Mesopotamia. Such an uprising would have been helpful to the British in its war against the Ottomans, lessening the threat against the Suez Canal. However, there was resistance from French diplomats who insisted that Syria's future was as a French colony and not as an independent Arab state. There were also strong objections from the government of India, which was nominally a part of the British government but acted independently. Its vision was of Mesopotamia under British control, serving as a granary for India. Furthermore, it wanted to hold on to its Arabian outpost in Aden. So you've got all sorts of geopolitics that is playing in here, and that's what actually led to the Arabs being let down. At the Arab Bureau, Lawrence supervised the preparation of maps, produced a daily bulletin for the British generals operating in the theatre, and interviewed prisoners. He was an advocate of a British landing at Alexandretta, which never came to pass, and he was also a consistent advocate of an independent Arab Syria. The situation came to a crisis in October 1915 as Sharif Hussein demanded an immediate commitment from Britain with the threat that he would otherwise throw his weight behind the Ottomans. This would create a credible pan-Islamic message that could have been dangerous for Britain, which was in severe difficulties in the Gallipoli campaign, which is Winston Churchill's great failure, which is well worth looking up. I think we discussed that in Truthful Out Radio in our series on Winston Churchill, if listeners want to look that up in the archives. The British replied with a letter from High Commissioner McMahon that was generally agreeable, while reserving commitments concerning the Mediterranean coastline and the Holy Land. So at least they were being honest there, because they did end up giving the Holy Land to the Jews. And Lebanon obviously became Lebanon. In the spring of 1916, Lawrence was dispatched to Mesopotamia to assist in relieving the siege of Kut by some combination of starting an Arab uprising and bribing Ottoman officials. The mission produced no useful result. Meanwhile, the Sykes-Picot Agreement was being negotiated in London without the knowledge of British officials in Cairo, which awarded a large proportion of Syria to France. Furthermore, it implied that the Arabs would have to conquer Syria's four great cities if they were to have any sort of state there: Damascus, Homs, Hama, and Aleppo. And it is unclear at what point Lawrence became aware of the treaty's contents. So that was the agreement that let them all down, the Sykes-Picot Agreement. I'm sure there's a Sykes-Picot line as well. That must be the line that separated the French territories from the British territories, because the British ended up with the mandate over Palestine, and the French ended up over Syria. Do you want to add any comments to that, Max?
Yeah, so there would have been the French, I think, held Lebanon and Syria, whereas the British held Palestine and Amman, and I'm pretty sure it would have been most of Saudi Arabia south of there as well.
Yeah, I wonder what Saudi Arabia was. So that was French. The Arab Revolt, or as it's sometimes called, the Arab Betrayal, or the Great Arab Revolt, was a military uprising of Arab forces against the Ottoman Empire in the Middle Eastern theater of World War I. On the basis of the McMahon-Hussein correspondence, an agreement between the British government and Hussein bin Ali, Sharif of Mecca, the revolt was officially initiated at Mecca on June 10th, 1916. So right in the holiest city to the Muslims, that's where the revolt was initiated. The aim of the revolt was to create a single, unified and independent Arab state stretching from Aleppo in Syria to Aden in Yemen, which the British had promised to recognise. The Sharifian army, led by Hussein and the Hashemites, with military backing from the British Egyptian Expeditionary Force, successfully fought and expelled the Ottoman military presence from much of the Hejaz and Transjordan. The rebellion eventually took Damascus and set up the Arab Kingdom of Syria, a short-lived monarchy led by Faisal, a son of Hussein. But following the Sykes-Picot Agreement, the Middle East was later partitioned by the British and French into mandate territories rather than a unified Arab state, and the British reneged on their promise to support a unified, independent Arab state. And I guess maybe they would have thought that the Arabs would have just been too strong then, if they had this great territory all to themselves. And we often forget that, you know, in the First World War, there was this war against the Ottoman Empire as well. It wasn't just England against Germany. And we had been allied with them before that, because General Gordon was working for the Ottomans. So this must have been a fairly recent thing happening around about 1900, that there was this split between the British and the Ottomans. Because, you know, we did used to send generals over there to fight with them and to show them our ways of doing things. General Gordon was, you know, he was an honorary part of the Ottoman Empire, wasn't he? I recall from when we were doing that. You got any final thoughts on this, Max? I think we'll leave it here.
Well, I think that Iraq and Iran were parts of the British Empire around about this time. Also Kuwait and then the smaller Arab states, But I think that the British government at the time probably could have honoured the agreement that they had given to the Arabs, because it still would have reduced this, what was the old Ottoman Empire, into a number of smaller, more easily dealt with chunks, because there would have been Iraq and Iran and Kuwait that would have been entirely separate. So I don't think there was any necessity for us from a military perspective to hold those areas there. I think perhaps though, from the point of view of the oil that they had, we probably got had still retained control in Iraq and Iran and Kuwait, the parts of that area that had the greatest amounts of oil, and also Saudi Arabia that had fairly large oil reserves as well. So from that perspective, it probably was quite a doable thing for us to have let the Arabs have that stretch of the Mediterranean coast and the hinterland attaching. But it was the fact that we had, through the Balfour Declaration, that we had promised a Jewish state in Palestine that was the fly in the ointment, really.
Yeah, that happened because we had the mandate for Palestine. And I was just thinking there as well, I mean, if you had that great long length of Arabs from Yemen all the way up to Syria, and that was just going to be one Arab state, that really shows that the countries that are there now are fairly new. The lines delineating them are fairly new. And this was the Jewish argument against the Palestinians, in fact. They were like, well, the Palestinians are Arabs, and they travel about all the time. They could always just travel to that area over there instead of being here in Palestine. And that's the Jewish argument. They say that Palestine was never a real country. None of these places were sort of real countries at the time until these lines were drawn on the map after the First World War. And we can see that here, because the Arabs were wanting to have this great area just as an independent Arab state for the various different Arab tribes to move around in and live in. And I think the Iranians were separate, because the Iranians were Shiites. So I don't think they would have been included in this. And Iran is sort of up above Syria, isn't it? What they're talking about is Syria to Yemen and Mesopotamia. And up above that, you've got Iran and you've got Afghanistan. And I think they would have been seen as separate. But as you say, maybe Iraq was included in it as well. So you can see that they had this feeling of, rather like Europeans today, you know, we're all white, we're white nationalists. And you had this same feeling there amongst these Arabs, these various different Arab tribes that were saying, well we are all Arabs and we are different to the Turkmen. We're different to these people that are running the Ottoman Empire. And we should have our own pan-Arab nationalism. We should have our own state based upon our ethnicity, basically. I mean, it was ethno-nationalism. So in a way, you could see that they put it down because it was ethno-nationalism as well. And I wonder what I was just thinking about the National Socialist relations with the Arabs. I know they had good relations with the Syrians, didn't they? And they had good relations with the Iranians, Persians.
Yeah, in the interwar period between the First World War and the Second World War, they grew up the Ba'ath Party, which existed in Egypt. It existed in Lebanon, in Syria, and I believe also Iraq and Saudi Arabia to some extent. And the Ba'ath philosophy was a both a nationalist and a socialist philosophy. The authors of the Ba'ath political program didn't identify themselves entirely with Nazi Germany, but they recognised that there were various nationalist leaders whose words were very inspirational to people who were trying to arouse Arab nationalism. They took a lot of their socialism, though, from Marx and from some of the more communist philosophers of the time. But the Ba'ath Party is undoubtedly an Arab version of National Socialism in my mind.
And the Ba'ath Party is the ruling party in Syria, isn't it? I don't think they yes. are in any of these other countries still, but in Syria. So that gives a bit of an explanation as to why Syria is seen as an enemy by the New World Order, because they've got these links here that go all the way back to pan-Arab ethno-nationalism and links to national socialism as well. Well, shall we go back to a brighter period in our past and talk about our greatest Britons, Max?
Yes, that would be great.
Let's talk some more about Lawrence of Arabia. Lawrence was born out of wedlock, but still had a fairly middle to upper class upbringing. As a youth, he cycled around collecting brass rubbings and surveying ancient castles, being fascinated by the Crusades and medieval life. As an adult, he first became an archaeologist, working with L.A. Woolley as well as with Flinders Petrie. With Woolley, he surveyed the Negev Desert and at the same time mapped it out for military intelligence to gain the upper hand against the Ottomans in the First World War. He learned a lot about Arab culture and became involved with encouraging Arab ethno-nationalism amongst the Ottomans' subjects, helping to plan and execute the Great Arab Revolt with them. This was expected to result in a huge Arab ethno-state stretching from Aden in Yemen to Damascus in Syria, but the British reneged on their promise, giving Syria to France and taking Palestine for themselves in order to pass it on to the Jews. And we're going to talk a little bit more about Arab nationalism, but before we do that, I'll just pass it over to you, Max. Is there anything else that you want to add to that recap?
No, I think that, you know, we said in previous weeks T. Lawrence was a member of the same group of very vigorous men that existed during that period in time. And who were responsible for the much greater status that the UK had during that time. People who took an interest in history, who took an interest in the process of civilization, or the rise of civilization, who realised that certain things promoted an enhanced civilization, whereas other things cause civilizations to become decadent and stultify. It's pleasing to look back and see that these people such as T. E. Lawrence existed. And what we must hope for the future is that men of his ilk come forward again and fill positions of influence and power in our country, and so that the vigour of our nation is restored.
Yeah, it was sort of peak alpha male time for Britain. We had more intellectuals, more highly intelligent people, just very, very strong, good examples of our phenotype. And I guess that would have been because the weak and the sickly were still dying at this time. If you actually managed to make it through to adulthood, then you would have had a very strong constitution. And with the strong constitution, you would have also been very bright. So as you pointed out, we had lots of polymaths that were around at this time. And it was really, I think it was the peak of Britain round about this time, when we had the British Empire just before the start of the First World War. And we had people that were just very good at everything that they did. And they didn't just concentrate on one thing. They concentrated on lots of different things. As we said, Lawrence was interested in castles, the Crusades. He was a great archaeologist. And he worked with these other great archaeologists as well, L.A. Woolley and Sir Flinders Petrie. And at the same time, he was an amazing spy as well, learning different languages. And of course, you can also tie this in with a little bit later on. We had Enoch Powell, another amazing intellectual and an incredible politician. All these amazing men that we used to have that just don't seem to appear nowadays. And of course, the IQ level is dropping on average every year, and it becomes more and more less likely that we're going to actually have more of these genius types that were good at everything. Well, let's move into a closer look at Arab nationalism then. The rise of nationalism in the Ottoman Empire dates from at least 1821. Arab nationalism has its roots in the Mashriq, which is the Arab lands east of Egypt, particularly in the countries of the Levant. The political orientation of Arab nationalists before World War I was generally moderate. Their demands were of a reformist nature and generally limited to autonomy, a greater use of Arabic in education, and changes in peacetime conscription in the Ottoman Empire to allow Arab conscripts local service in the Ottoman army. And this reminds me of the British wanting to be allowed into the Roman army, and the Vandals wanting to be allowed into the Roman army. And it just seems surprising when you think about it that people would want to go and join another people's army. But apparently that's so. I mean, why do you think that is, Max? Why would they be campaigning to be allowed to join the Ottoman army, do you think?
I think that there probably would have been a perception on the part of many Arabs that the Ottomans were of a similar genetic stock to them. There would have been more Turks, more people of Turkish origins amongst the Ottomans, I suppose. But the whole of the Middle East is effectively a mixture of peoples, ranging from Arabs through Turks and Hamites along the north coast of Africa. And what are described as people of Nilotic origin in the Nile Valley, and I think that there's an old saying that nothing succeeds like success. Everybody loves a winner, and if you are born into a community which is marginalised, but right next door to and adjacent to an empire that's being forged by people who seem to have greater energy and greater determination and fortitude, then that success becomes an attractive thing in itself and makes people want to join in.
Well, I guess that, yeah, I guess they wanted to be seen as equals, didn't they? The Arabs wanted to be seen as equals to the Ottomans, so they wanted to join the Ottoman Empire, and the same with the British and the Roman Empire and the Vandals with the Roman Empire. So that explains it. In 1913, intellectuals and politicians from the Mashriq met in Paris at the First Arab Congress. They produced a set of demands for greater autonomy and equality within the Ottoman Empire, including for elementary and secondary education in Arab lands to be delivered in Arabic, for peacetime Arab conscripts to the Ottoman army to serve near their home region, and for at least three Arab ministers in the Ottoman cabinet. So they wanted representation as well. By 1916, the Arabs were wanting their own single, unified and independent Arab state, stretching from Aleppo in Syria to Aden in Yemen, which the British had promised to recognise if the Arabs would succeed in a revolt against the Ottomans. So they've gone on from wanting to be taught in Arabic because they're Arabs, to wanting representation in the government of the empire, to now wanting an ethno-state. So, you know, it's a quite natural thing to want to be with your own people. And the British promised that they would recognise this, they would give the Arabs this state if they would revolt against the Ottomans, because remember, they were serving under the Ottomans with this conscription. The main contribution of the Arab revolt to the war was to pin down tens of thousands of Ottoman troops who otherwise might have been used to attack the Suez Canal, which is owned by Britain, and conquering Damascus, allowing the British to undertake offensive operations with a lower risk of counterattack. This was indeed the British justification for supporting the revolt, a textbook example of asymmetric warfare that has been studied time and again by military leaders and historians alike. The great weakness of the Ottoman forces was that they were at the end of a long and tenuous supply line in the form of the Hejaz Railway, and because of their logistical weaknesses, they were often forced to fight on the defensive. Ottoman offences against the Hashemite forces more often than not faltered due to supply problems rather than the actions of the enemy. The Sherifan army, led by Hussein and the Hashemites with military backing from the British Egyptian Expeditionary Force, successfully fought and expelled the Ottoman military presence from much of the Hejaz and Transjordan. The rebellion eventually took Damascus and set up the Arab Kingdom of Syria, a short-lived monarchy led by Faisal, a son of Hussein. Following the Sykes-Picot Agreement, the Middle East was later partitioned by the British and French into Mandate territories, rather than as a unified Arab state, and the British reneged on their promise to support a unified, independent Arab state. And this is really the reason why the Jews would say about the Palestinians, well, can't they just go to another country? And we'll say, ah, yes, but you can't just move to another country. But back then, the Arabs were wanting the whole area. They were wanting from Yemen to Syria to be this Arabic ethno-state. So what the Jews are effectively saying is, well, it doesn't, surely the Palestinians can just move to that Transjordan area, which is an Arab area. Why do they have to have this area? So, you know, you have to look at what things were like back then, what the Arabs were asking for, and what they have now. It's not like those countries that we see in the Middle East, they've always been there. Lebanon, Jordan, Syria, the way that it is now. It was that they wanted this whole area, and the Arabs themselves were nomadic. They would move from one place to another. And again, this all ties in with the birth of Israel and the Balfour Agreement, which took place after this. And it looks like Lawrence was not aware of this, that the British were going to go back on their promise. And he supported the Arabs. Any thoughts on any of that, Max?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that all the Arabs were nomadic, and so therefore they shouldn't really have had a claim to any of the land. I think that some Arabic tribes have traditionally been nomadic, but there are lots of Arab peoples, particularly those that lived in Palestine and the Levant, who would have been settled. If you think back through history, I think Damascus is the oldest city in the world. Actually, it's claimed to be the oldest city in the world, and it's the centre of cereal domestication and the growing of domestic cereal crops in order to provide food. And so the people who have lived traditionally around Damascus, they would have been settled for millennia. And so that they would have a claim to the land just as strong as any other indigenous people, basically. But the denial of their rights and the aspirations to have this sort of Arab state led ultimately to the creation of Baathism, spelt B-A-B-A-A-T-H, Baathism. Which is as we discussed a while back, which is an Arab form of a mixture of nationalism and socialism. The man who's credited with forming Baathism was a chap called Michel Aflaq, and he was a great admirer of Marx and also of Lenin, as well as other nationalist leaders in the 20th century.
Yeah, the Ba'ath Party is Bashar al-Assad is a leader of the Ba'ath Party. I think the Ba'ath Party had representation in all these different Arab countries originally, and it was supportive of nationalism. And that's another reason why they're against the Syrians, I guess, is because they go back to this Ba'ath Party that had support from National Socialism. I think they have a National Socialist Party or a Socialist Nationalist Party over there in Syria. They certainly had a strong sense of ethnic solidarity, and they had this ethno-nationalism movement which was being used by the British. So the British were using them as proxies against the Ottomans. And as it says here, I mean, that's asymmetrical warfare. It's still used today. I mean, we can see similar things sort of happening in Ukraine, being used as a proxy against Russia. And we saw that the rebels were being used as a proxy against Gaddafi in Libya. The same with the Syrian rebels are being used as a proxy against Syria. So we had the same thing that was going on back then. And these Arabs were basically being used by Britain to try and weaken the Ottomans. And this Sykes-Picot agreement, this was a 1916 secret treaty between the United Kingdom and France, with assent from the Russian Empire and the Kingdom of Italy, to define their mutually agreed spheres of influence and control in an eventual partition of the Ottoman Empire. The agreement was based on the premise that the Triple Entente would achieve success in defeating the Ottoman Empire during World War I and form part of a series of secret agreements contemplating its partition. The primary negotiations leading to the agreement took place between 23rd November 1915 and 3rd of January 1916, on which date the British and French diplomats Mark Sykes and François-Georges Picot initialled an agreed memorandum, and the agreement was ratified by their respective governments on the 9th and the 16th of May 1916. The agreement effectively divided the Ottoman provinces outside the Arabian Peninsula into areas of British and French control and influence. The British and French-controlled countries were divided by the Sykes-Picot line. The agreement allocated to the UK control of what is today southern Israel and Palestine, Jordan and southern Iraq, and an additional small area that included the ports of Haifa and Acre to allow access to the Mediterranean. And France was to control southeastern Turkey, the Kurdistan region, Syria and Lebanon. So you can see these original countries were sort of split in half by this line. As a result of the included Sazonov-Palaiologue agreement, Russia was to get Western Armenia in addition to Constantinople, and the Turkish Straits already promised under the 1915 Constantinople Agreement. Italy assented to the agreement in 1917 via the Agreement of Saint-Jean-de-Maurienne and received southern Anatolia. The Palestine region, with a smaller area than the later Mandatory Palestine, was to fall under an international administration. I think that's why it still falls under UN administration. But this is the first that I've actually heard of this. So Constantinople was promised to Russia. So why is it now part of Turkey? Why did the Turks get Constantinople back? You would have thought that Eastern Orthodox Russia would have wanted to keep a hold of that. Any idea, Max? Do you know about this agreement here, that it went to Russia?
No, not specifically. I can only assume. I mean, there has been fighting between the various nations in and around the Black Sea for many decades, and so what will have probably happened is that during the Second World War, probably there would have been a stronger effort made by the Turks to secure the Straits of the Bosporus, and because it may well be that so the Turks fought on our side instead of fighting on the side of the Germans as they did during the First World War, that the Allies may have allowed them to have the Straits of the Bosporus, perhaps conditionally, on condition that they maintained the Straits as an international waterway rather than using it as a means of dominating trade backwards and forwards between the Black Sea areas and the rest of the Mediterranean.
Well, you can also see from this, you know, we learn about the Versailles Treaty and how that set up the Second World War, and it partitioned Germany and gave bits of Germany to Poland and what have you. And we can see the same thing was happening here. You know, bits of Turkey are being given to Russia, bits of Armenia go to Russia, Italy gets certain parts, France gets a little bit of Turkey, Kurdistan region, which is just a region which didn't actually end up with a country, even though there is the Kurds, the ethnic group. There's Kurds in Iraq, Turkey, Iran, Syria. They're in all these places, but they actually have a region, but they weren't actually given a country. So you can see that it wasn't just the Germans that were upset after the end of the First World War. All these countries.
It's because of the Sykes-Picot agreement that lots of these countries in the Middle East, that their boundaries are just straight lines. Somebody has just obviously got a map of the Middle East, put a ruler on it, and then just drawn a line straight across, saying, well, everybody north of that, or all the land north of that, is going to be called Iraq, for example. All the land south of that is going to be called Saudi Arabia, and then drawn another line, all the land to the east of that is going to be called Syria, the rest of it's going to be called Lebanon, and this, you know, and it's been divided up that way. And you're quite right, as far as the Kurds are concerned. The Kurds have occupied an area of eastern Anatolia for thousands of years. They've always been dragged backwards and forwards by various stronger powers throughout history, and when the modern day boundaries were decided. Somebody took their ruler and drew across the Kurdish areas and divided Kurdistan into, I don't know, four or five different chunks each, then that would fall under the auspices of a different local power.
You can see it's just setting up strife, isn't it? I mean, you can see why there's so much trouble in the Middle East, because you've got these different ethnic groups that have been told, right, well, this is your country. I mean, how are you going to get any patriotic feeling there for a country when half your relatives are living in the country next door because there's a line that's just been drawn down the map there? You know, you're not going to get the national feeling that you need from a shared ethnicity, which is, you know, why the Arabs had this ethno-nationalism and why they wanted this ethno-state in the first place. So, you know, it's just setting up problems for the future. It doesn't just happen with Europeans. Or getting back to Lawrence of Arabia here and the Arab revolt. The revolt began in June 1916, but it got bogged down after a few successes with a real risk that the Ottoman forces would advance along the coast of the Red Sea and recapture Mecca. So they actually captured Mecca, the most holiest city to do with Islam. On the 16th of October 1916, Lawrence was sent to the Hejaz on an intelligence-gathering mission led by Ronald Storrs. He interviewed Sharif Hussein's sons, Ali, Abdullah and Faisal, and he concluded that Faisal was the best candidate to lead the revolt. And remember, Faisal was made into the king. In November, SF Newcomb was assigned to lead a permanent British liaison to Faisal's staff. Newcomb had not yet arrived in the area and the matter was of some urgency, so Lawrence was sent in his place. In late December 1916, Faisal and Lawrence worked out a plan for repositioning the Arab forces to put the railway from Syria under threat while preventing the Ottoman forces around Medina from threatening the Arab positions. Newcomb arrived while Lawrence was preparing to leave Arabia, but Faisal intervened urgently, asking that Lawrence's assignment become permanent. So they preferred to have Lawrence leading them rather than Newcomb. Lawrence's most important contributions to the Arab revolt were in the area of strategy and liaison with the British armed forces, but he also participated personally in several military engagements. An attack on the Ottoman outpost in the Hejaz, an attack on the railway at Abba el Nam, an attack on a bridge at Ras Baalbek, defeat of the Ottoman forces of Abba el Lisan, an outpost of Aqaba, attack on the railway near Madwara, attack on the railway, destroying an engine. Following a failed attack on the Yarmouk bridges, he blew up a train on the railway between Deraa and Amman, suffering several wounds in the explosion and ensuing combat. Remember, this is an archaeologist. I mean, he was an archaeologist, then he was a spy, and now he's a marine. 1918, the Battle of Tafila, a region southeast of the Dead Sea, with Arab regulars under the command of Jafar Pasha al-Askari. The battle was a defensive engagement that turned into an offensive rout and was described in the official history of the war as a brilliant feat of arms. Lawrence was awarded the Distinguished Service Order for his leadership at Tafila and was promoted to Lieutenant Colonel. March 1918, attack on the railway near Aqaba. He also made an attack using British armoured cars on Tel Sham, destruction of a railway bridge between Amman and Deraa, and in September 1918, an attack on retreating Ottomans and Germans near the village of Tafas. The Ottoman forces massacred the villagers, and then the Arab forces in return massacred their own prisoners with Lawrence's encouragement. Lawrence made a 300-mile personal journey northwards in June 1917 on the way to Aqaba, visiting Ras Baalbek, the outskirts of Damascus, and Azraq, Jordan. He met Arab nationalists, counselling them to avoid revolt until the arrival of Faisal's forces, and he attacked a bridge to create the impression of guerrilla activity. His findings were regarded by the British as extremely valuable, and there was serious consideration of awarding him a Victoria Cross, but in the end he was invested as a Companion of the Order of the Bath and promoted to Major. Lawrence travelled regularly between British headquarters and Faisal, coordinating the military action. But by early 1918, Faisal's chief British liaison was Colonel Piers Charles Joyce, and Lawrence's time was chiefly devoted to raiding and intelligence gathering. So he must have really like lived as an Arab at this time, as a spy and leading the troops here in all these activities. And you remember, I mean, this guy was just trained as an archaeologist And suddenly he's leading these Arab forces and having all these successes as well. I mean, he's got to have a lot of courage there, hasn't he? Do you think?
Yeah, I think he was one of these characters that exhibited what used to be called derring do, who was an adventurer and who was more than willing to risk his life in the pursuit of those adventures, basically, and the sort of person that romantic action stories are written about. And and that's one of the reasons why his name has perpetuated in history and he's become as famous as he has.
Yeah, and we're talking about 100 years later. The chief elements of the Arab strategy, which Faisal and Lawrence developed, were to avoid capturing Medina and to extend northwards through Ma'an and Deraa to Damascus and beyond. Faisal wanted to lead regular attacks against the Ottomans, but Lawrence persuaded him to drop that tactic. Lawrence wrote about the Bedouin as a fighting force. The value of the tribes is defensive only, and their real sphere is guerrilla warfare. They are intelligent and very lively, almost reckless, but too individualistic to endure commands or to fight in a line or to help each other. It would, I think, be possible to make an organized force out of them. The Hejaz War is one of dervishes against regular forces, and we are on the side of the dervishes. Our textbooks do not apply to its conditions at all. So you've got the racial character there as well. It's difficult to get an organized force out of them. They're too individualistic, but they're very intelligent and very lively. And he's talking about the dervishes there. I think they're the Sufis. So that was a particular type of Islam were the dervishes and the Sufis, whirling dervishes. Medina was an attractive target for the revolt as Islam's second holiest site, and because its Ottoman garrison was weakened by disease and isolation. It became clear that it was advantageous to leave it there rather than try to capture it while attacking the Hejaz railway south from Damascus without permanently destroying it. This prevented the Ottomans from making effective use of their troops at Medina and forced them to dedicate many resources to defending and repairing the railway line because they've got to get their supplies. It is not known when Lawrence learned the details of the Sykes-Picot Agreement, nor if or when he briefed Faisal on what he knew. However, there is good reason to think that both these things happened and earlier rather than later. In particular, the Arab strategy of northwards extension makes perfect sense given the Sykes-Picot language that spoke of an independent Arab entity in Syria, which would only be granted if the Arabs liberated the territory themselves. The French and some of their British liaison officers were specifically uncomfortable about the northwards movement, as it would weaken French colonial claims. So I guess he would have ended up with split loyalties there. Should my loyalties be to the Arabs, who I've spent all this time with, building up a bond with them, or should my loyalties be to Britain and what Britain wants at the end of the war? And he seems to have been trying to help the Arabs here by directing them to go north and to take Syria, so that they ended up being given Syria, I think. Any thoughts on that, Max?
I think your interpretation there is quite correct. You know that his loyalties would have been split. I think that because he'd spent so long with the Arabs, you know, he would have gone native, in inverted commas, as they say, and that he would have been very strongly emotionally invested in the interests of the Arab allies that he had mustered and that he'd organised and directed in the war against the Ottomans. And so, I think he would have had strong feelings and he would have wanted an outcome for the Arabs that the Arabs would have regarded as being equitable. Obviously the agreement that had been reached, the Sykes-Picot agreement, wasn't that.
Yeah, it was going to deny them this huge, great ethno-state. In 1917, Lawrence proposed a joint action with the Arab irregulars and forces, including Audu Abu Tayy, who had previously been in the employ of the Ottomans, against the strategically located but lightly defended town of Aqaba on the Red Sea. Aqaba could have been attacked from the sea, but the narrow defiles leading through the mountains were strongly defended and would have been very difficult to assault. The expedition was led by Sharif Nazir of Medina. Lawrence avoided informing his British superiors about the details of the planned inland attack due to concern that it might be blocked as being contrary to French interests. The expedition departed from Wedge on 9th of May, and Aquaba fell to the Arab forces on the 6th of July after a surprise overland attack which took the Turkish defences from behind. After Aquaba, General Sir Edmund Allenby, the new commander-in-chief of the Egyptian Expeditionary Force, agreed to Lawrence's strategy for the revolt. Lawrence now held a powerful position as an advisor to Faisal and a person who had Allenby's confidence, as Allenby acknowledged after the war, saying, "I gave him a free hand. His cooperation was marked by the utmost loyalty, and I never had anything but praise for his work, which indeed was invaluable throughout the campaign. He was the mainspring of the Arab movement and knew their language, their manners, and their mentality." So he was really the leader of the Arab nationalist movement, was this white guy all dressed up in Arab uniform. I mean, that's the famous picture of him, isn't it?
That's right.
Lawrence describes an episode on the 20th of November 1917 while reconnoitering Deraa in disguise when he was captured by the Ottoman military, beaten and sexually assaulted by the local bey and his guardsmen, although he does not specify the nature of the sexual contact. Some scholars have stated that he exaggerated the severity of the injuries that he suffered, or alleged that the episode never happened. There is no independent testimony, but the multiple consistent reports and the absence of evidence for outright invention in Lawrence's works makes the account believable to some of his biographers. Malcolm Brown, Johnny Mack, and Jeremy Wilson have argued that this episode had strong psychological effects on Lawrence, which may explain some of his unconventional behaviour in later life. Lawrence ended his account of the episode in Seven Pillars of Wisdom with the statement, "In Deraa that night, the citadel of my integrity had been irrevocably lost." Poor man. I mean, he was really tortured there. He was lucky to live. I mean, I guess they must have not worked out who he was. And they just beat him and assaulted him. But they didn't actually know who he was. I mean, if they'd known who he was, I think they would have kept him, and he wouldn't have managed to escape. I mean, the horrors that this man withstood, basically, for his country. Lawrence was involved in the build-up to the capture of Damascus in the final weeks of the war, but he was not present at the city's formal surrender, much to his disappointment. He arrived several hours after the city had fallen, entering Damascus around 9 a.m. on 1st of October 1918. The first to arrive was the 10th Australian Light Horse Brigade, led by Major ACN Harry Alden, who accepted the formal surrender of the city from Acting Governor Emir Said. Lawrence was instrumental in establishing a provisional Arab government under Faisal in newly liberated Damascus, which he had envisioned as the capital of an Arab state. Faisal's rule as king, however, came to an abrupt end in 1920, that's just 2 years later, after the Battle of Maysalun, when the French forces of General Gerard entered Damascus under the command of General Mariano Goybe, destroying Lawrence's dream of an independent Arabia. During the closing years of the war, Lawrence sought to convince his superiors in the British government that Arab independence was in their interests, but he met with mixed success. The secret Sykes-Picot agreement between France and Britain contradicted the promises of independence that he had made to the Arabs and frustrated his work. So he was really let down by his superiors. And I think he's been proved true, but his fears have been proven to be true when we look at the troubles that we see in the Middle East now, as we were saying, with these lines that have been drawn there. And I mean, he knew that people of one ethnicity, they want to be together with their ethnicity. They don't want to be split up. Multiculturalism doesn't work. So he's saying it would have been in Britain's interests to give these Arabs the state that they wanted. But maybe even the Balfour Agreement played into this, and this wish to give Palestine to the Jews, because I think that would have played a part in it, wouldn't it? I'm trying to think where Yemen is on the map, if it stretches.
Yemen is the very southernmost corner of the Saudi Arabian Peninsula. So you'd have to travel south from Mecca. Mecca is quite close to Aqaba and quite close to the southern part of Israel. But if you then travel along the the northern coast of the Red Sea south, where you reach the corner of the Arabian Peninsula. That's where Aden is.
So it might have actually left out that part anyway, this Arab state. Surely not, because the Palestinians were Arabs, weren't they? So that must have formed a part of it. So I guess maybe that played into it. You know, this idea that they wanted to give the Jews that part, that little part.
Well, are you saying that the Sykes-Picot Agreement wanted to give the Jews Aden as well?
No. I'm saying that the British, why they didn't want to support this ethno-state. I mean, part of it may have been that they wanted to give Palestine to the Jews. Because, I mean, it doesn't really make sense why they wouldn't.
I think that's obviously the reason why. You know, the Balfour Declaration had been made so that international Jewry would campaign in the United States to bring the Americans into the First World War on the side of the Allies. In return for international Jewry doing that, the Balfour Declaration was signed promising the Jews a homeland in Palestine.
So that definitely would have played into this then. It's a shame they didn't get their ethno state, you know. And it's good that they had this sense of nationalism and this sense of ethnic solidarity rather like we see men doing better as women today. We see Lawrence of Arabia being the best of the Arabs. It was actually a white man that was leading them. Thank you very much for listening, and watch out for part two in our presentation on T.E. Lawrence here at RadioAlbion.com.